Good evening. Can you hear me? I'm sorry, I have to tiptoe. Welcome to Writers at Warwick. I'm Maureen Freely of the Warwick Writing Program, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome back Will Self to Warwick. He needs absolutely no introduction, so I'm going to hand him right over to you. Welcome, Will Self.
Come, my pretties, seat yourselves. This is a very, very lovely arts centre, and this is one of the most depressing light qualities I've ever seen outside of an Albanian public toilet. Is there any possibility we could take it down a bit? Because if not, I fear I may kill myself. Ah, that's better. Or even down a bit more. And even down a bit more. That's better. So you think? Now at least we can't see what it is we're getting up to. however disgusting it is. And it will be disgusting. I can guarantee you that. Well, there's still some people. Come, my pretties. I'm going to read to you a bit from this book, what I have written, and then I'll happily take some questions. That's pretty much it. I'm going to read you two sections of it. I think I'll probably read you two sections. I may just flake out after one. And it's about, if you don't know anything, but it's called The Book of Dave, and it's about a mentally unbalanced London taxi driver who writes a jeremiad against the contemporary world. Which he then buries in the garden of his ex-wife. Hundreds of years pass, London is flooded, perhaps by global warming, and this strange book is disinterred and becomes the holy writ of a future society. Simple, really. So in this section, I introduce you to my slightly mentally unbalanced London cabbie, who's called Dave Rudman. The Book of Dave. Hunched low over the wheel, fog lamps piercing the miasma, Dave Rudman powered his cab through the chicane at the bottom of Park Lane. The cabbie's furious thoughts shot through the windscreen and ricocheted off the unfeeling world. Achilles was up on his plinth with his tiny bronze cock, his black shield fending off the hair-styling wand of the Hilton where all my heartache began. Solid clouds hung overhead, langing up fresh blood. The gates to Hyde Park, erected for the Queen Mother, looked like bent paper clips in the gloom. The lion and unicorn on their Warner Brothers' escutcheon were prancing cartoon characters. Evil be to him who thinks of it, said the unicorn, and the lion replied, "Ee, what's up, Doc?" Stuttering by them, Rudman's Fairdar picked up a Burberry bundle trapped on the heel of grass that was cut off from the central reservation by the taut tarmac tendon of Achilles' Way. Stupid plonker. The cab's wipers went, eek, eek. The bundle was trying to roll over the Y-shaped crash barrier, all that prevented him from being mown down by the four lanes of traffic that came whipping past the war memorial where bronze corpses lay beneath concrete howitzers. Tatty coaches full of carrot crunchers up for the Xmas wallet fuck. Pale-skinned, rust-grazed transit vans with England flags taped across their back windows. Boogaloo brothers in 7-series BMWs. Throw cushion specialists in skateboard-sized smart cars. Conan the fucking barbarian motorcycle couriers. Warped, flatbed trucks piled high with scrap metal. One-eyed old Routemaster buses. The whole stinky caravan of London wholesale to retail, 5 credit-worthy days before Christmas, was intent on crushing this bit of Yank wannabe roadkill. So Dave slewed the fairway over to the near side lane and waited to see whether he'd make it. He did. He came puffing up to the driver's side window.
Sir, sir, excuse me, sir. Sir? Sir? Is he fucking insane? Thank you for stopping.
He's going to ask me if I know which fear the King and I is playing at, stupid cunt.
Could you take me to...
The Yank drew a piece of paper from his trench coat pocket and consulted it.
Mill Hill.
He said the two words slowly and distinctly, as if they might be difficult for Dave to comprehend.
If that's not kind of beyond your range.
My range?
What do you think I am, some fucking wild boar?
Dave pictured beastly London cabs rolling in the roadway, shaking their metal shoulders to rid themselves of railings hurled by hoorays starved of sport.
Get in, please.
Dave bent his arm out of the window and opened the door, then he shrugged back inside and hit the meter. The bundle bowled in, a grateful blob of wet gabardine that wafted a gentle stench of some male fragrance advertised by chest-waxing ponces in their underpants. Dave Rudman shifted the cab into drive and shuddered off up the near side lane, expertly swerving to avoid a coach that lurched out of its bay. Then he rubbed his sore nostrils with a wad of tissue as shapeless as snot.
Day and fucking night, nurse. That's what you need in this job. Open the hatch and through it comes another slant-eyed virus at 120 mile an hour.
The fare sat in the middle of the back seat, knees akimbo, pot belly exposed by the open flaps of his trench coat, both hands on the safety handles set in the rear doors of the cab, as if he's in a rickshaw costing 25 fucking grand.
When I say range, cabby, said the fare,
leaning forward to push his fat face through the open hatch,
I mean, I've heard of your famous knowledge, but I figure that maybe Mill Hill is a bit beyond it, beyond the area you have to cover.
He's a talker, this one. He wants to talk. He goes to whores, and when they try to plate him, he says he'd rather talk. Because the only thing he wants in their mouths is comforting words. He'll start on fucking Afghanistan in 2 minutes flat. He's going to go all Tora Bora on me.
That's right. It is a little beyond the 6 mile radius from Charing Cross, which is the theoretical limit of the London streets we have to learn.
Theoretical? He doesn't expect to hear this word out of my lower class lips. Lips he sees flapping in the rear view. He's putting together a photo fit of me from lips, chin and the back of my head. He ain't fooled by the baseball cap and he likes that I'm going bald. As a fatty, it gives him the drop.
Yeah, putting still more at his ease, this cunt could be an earner. Theoretical, because in practice we also have to know a fair bit of the suburbs, which would cover Mill Hill as well.
Uh-huh. The fare was satisfied. He'd marked his card. He'd shown Dave he wasn't just another dumb tourist who thinks London is a 900-square-mile souvenir T-shirt decorated with tit-helmeted coppers, red phone boxes, Mohican sporters, tiara jockeys, and black bloody cabs. The fare looked to the left at the avenue of plane trees running up to Speaker's Corner. He looked to the right
at the tiny road-cleaning machine bumping along the gutter, its circular electric brushes polishing the York stone molars. He was lost, momentarily, in a reverie provoked by a pair of backpacking lovers, wet weather freaks who were leaning up against the lip of a fountain, her thighs imprisoned in his. He was thinking about his family and Afghanistan. Kind of weird being in Europe. I imagine you'd rather be at home, what with all this business in Afghanistan. You bet I would. Sure, it's crazy to think you're any more at risk here, or your family's any more at risk if you're not there, but still, you'd rather be with them. And so would I. In a small, clean family hotel in Gloucester Place, 70 quid a night, walking tour of Bloomsbury Inclusive, two big burger-stuffed kids, plenty of metalwork in their mouths, mum in a beige trouser suit. I want his family so I can slot them in the gap left by my own. I'd booked the flight before 9/11. I figured it would be like giving succor to the enemy if I didn't come over. Gotcha. Eek! Eek! The wipers went. The cab braked, then heeled over to join the other rusty hulks cruising around Marble Arch, a reef of Nash that loomed up out of the silty drizzle. I tell you something, cabbie. Tell me everything you've done, motherfucker. Pour it all out. I didn't vote for Bush, but I reckon he's handling this okay. And it wasn't the Twin Towers that set me against these Taliban fellows, though heavens to Betsy, it was a terrible thing. But I knew these were dreadful people when they blew up those two ancient statues of the Buddha. You know the ones? Yes. Fellows, heavens to Betsy. Any folk who could destroy a thing of ancient beauty so brutally, well, nothing they could do would surprise me after that, and the way they treat their women, too. So far as I'm concerned, the way they treat their women is the best thing going for those fuckers. Keep those bints in line, I say. You take my ex. She's only gone and slapped a fucking restraining order on me. Now, that had never happened in Kabul. I'd have her trussed up in one of them black cloaky things before she could say CSA. I couldn't agree with you more. Very sad business. Because they should go a bit bloody further. Take the kids off of them. No kids, no power over us. Past the Odeon, with its egg box roof, the cab squealed to a halt at some lights, and the meter, which had been ticking away with generous increments, slowed to a trickle of pence. After 15 years of cabbing, Dave Rudman was so finely attuned to the meter that he could minutely calibrate it with his own outgoings. At the beginning of each day, a spreadsheet popped up behind his heavy eyelids, and as he drove, picking up and dropping off, ranking up and driving again, so the figures were instantly calculated to inform him whether he was ahead or behind. If he could pay for his diesel, his insurance, his cab repayments, his food, his fags, his booze, his prescriptions, his child support, and Cohen, his divorce lawyer. At 8 p.m., when the second tariff ban comes in, the figures alter accordingly. At 10 p.m., when the third starts, they change again. Time, distance, and money, the three dimensions of Dave Rudman's universe. Up above it all was the flying eye. Russ Kane, trying to make a joke out of a fucking lorry what shit its load at the Robin Hood roundabout. Dave Rudman hardly ever used to go into the dozen or so cabbies' shelters that were still scattered about central London. However, nowadays he was so skint he needed the cheap and greasy fuel the old biddies who ran them pumped out. They were weird little structures, the shelters, like antediluvian cricket pavilions of green wood which the city had grown up around. Inside, the cabbies sat, jawing and noshing, at a table covered with a plastic cloth. So many cabbies, their faces dissipated by the life, like those of prematurely aged peasants, worn out by their bigoted credo. Dave didn't want to talk about the lost boy, but last week, in the shelter in Grosvenor Gardens, when Sam Pillock of a cabbie, seeing Dave's face, horsey with depression, stupidly asked what was eating him. Dave spilled. Then the other cabbie quipped, "A woman is like an hurricane. When they pitch up, they're wet and wild. And when they bugger off, they take your house and your car." But Michelle hadn't only taken Dave's house. She'd got a bigger, flasher one. She'd even got a new daddy for Dave's boy. And how fucking sick is that? As for this Cohen cow, who was milking Dave, she must have a fucking meter in her desk drawer. And every time I bell her, she pops it on and it goes up and up, 50 quid at a time, a oneer for a letter. Then there's the brief she gets to stand up on his hind legs in the judge's chambers for a grand a pop, but I bet she gets a kickback though. Cow. Lawyers. They're all scum. As the cab crawled up the Edgware Road, the fair looked bemused by the shiny pavements, thronged by Arabs. Arabs sitting behind the plate glass windows of Marouche, supping fruit juices and smoking shishas. Arabs stopping at kiosks to buy their newspapers full of squashed fly print. Their women flapped along behind them, tagged and bagged, but under their chardals they're tricked out like fucking tarts in silk undies. They are. It gives them a big turn on. And my ex, with her little job up in Hampstead, wrapping up thongs in fucking tissue paper, she's just the same. They're all the same. Where to in Mill Hill exactly, Gov? Dave, some people think he's rather unsympathetic, but I don't. And he buries this book, the child he's lost contact with, he writes this strange kind of rant, really. Is that nice? Good. And buries it in this guy. It's quite crinkly, though, isn't it? Yes. Crinkly. I always thought those crinkly drinks were like, they were like the sort of Betamax format videotapes or 8-track CD players. You know, they came in, well, long before you were born, actually, in the 1970s. And you know what? We thought they'd go out because cardboard cartons came in, but no, there it is, like some sort of strange throwback to the 1970s sitting on that desk. I hope I haven't made you feel self-conscious about having a drink, because I think you should just press right on so it crinkles a little. Do you think that any, you know, of our leaders would pause if they were at some conference and some other leader of the free world said, "Mr. Blair, that drink's a little crinkly"? No, of course it wouldn't. So he buries this book, and hundreds of years in the future, it's disinterred. His ex-wife, as we've gathered, lives in Hampstead, which, if anybody knows London, is high on a hill. So when London's flooded, it's left as a little island. And on this little island live a people who, with awesome predictability, are called hamsters. And I don't really need to tell you a lot more about these hamsters who adhere to the tenets of the Book of Day, except that they have rather strange livestock, which are these creatures called motos. And I can only really read to you from the glossary to describe what a moto is like, though you're going to meet one in a minute. A moto is a large, viviparous, omnivorous mammalian creature, native to Ham and found nowhere else, used by the hamsters as a source of meat and oil alone. It has rather blubbery flesh. The moto has the functional intelligence of a 2.5-year-old human child. Okay, so that's the motos. And in this little scene I'm going to read you of this kind of, frankly, rather bizarre future world, we're going to be present at the slaughter of a moto. The six gaffs of the hamster's little manor were set in two rows of three on each side of an Evian stream that was rich in irony. At the western end, a seventh, used as a travelodge, was built above the spring itself. Pod-shaped, the gaffs hunkered down into the land, their rough, reddish sides hugged by the green sward, their lumpy, thatched roofs lashed down by crude ropes. For hundreds of years, perhaps even since the dawn of the knowledge itself, for the gaffs were known to be very ancient, they had gone by the names of the six clans of Ham. To the south of the stream, running from east to west, were the Edens, Funch, and Bruti gaffs, while on the north side were the Divush, the Ridman, and the Bullock. The breakup had not changed this, although the dads now occupied the gaffs to the south of the stream and the mummies those to the north. That the hamsters should cleave so to this redundant nomenclature was only one of the reasons why their driver was now insisting that the unsanitary manor, with its dwellings shared by kith and kine, be demolished and a new one built. On a frayed patch of ground a few paces from the Ridman Gaff, Fred Ridman, the governor of Ham, together with three of the other dads, had knocked together a gibbet big enough to hang the moto from once its throat had been cut. In late autumn, when several motos were slaughtered, such a gibbet would have been far larger, and all the hamstermen would have spent a blob or more building it. However, for this, the midsummer's feast for the hacks party, only one moto was to be slaughtered. This was Runty, who now lay on his side, slash flesh squidging from under him, his tank slopping, his arse bubbling. His legs were lashed with some of the better imported rope, a length of which was also slung over the top beam of the gibbet. At the moto's head knelt Carl, together with his stepdad, Fred. Carl held a small knife that was hidden in the dense wattles of the beast's throat. Fred was tall, like all of the Ridman clan, his hair lanky, his beard a lustrous curly brown, his eyes a stony grey, his lips sickle sharp and sickle curved. He was a divine dad, so he called over the slaughter run. "Leave on right, Smithfield, left Poultry Avenue, left Charterhouse, right Farringdon Lane." His stepson stroked Runty's stubbly brow as the run and its points were called.
"Time to go now, Runty," he said. "Not hurting?"
the moto lisped.
"Nah, not hurting. You'll hardly feel it."
This was true, because at that very instant, Carl pressed the knife deep into the beast's neck, and a maroon tide pulsed out onto the bare earth.
"Pull up!"
Fred cried to Fucker Funch, Sid Broody, and Aussie Bullock. The three dads began hauling on the end of the rope. It came taut, and the moto's bleeding body was dragged jerkily towards the wooden frame, leaving an old irony stain in its wake.
"Kiss an end!"
Fucker shouted to the gang of chillmen, who were standing away off, looking on both enthralled and horrified. Reluctantly, the hacks peddlers detached themselves from the group, strolled over, and grabbed the rope. All eight dads gathered as much purchase as they could and pulled. Their muscles knotted, their backs creaked, the gibbet groaned, first Runty's hindquarters, then his sagging tank lifted from the ground. Carl stayed by his head, whispering endearments.
"It's all right, lovey. Don't worry. Here we go. Not long now. It'll be better when you're up on the thingy." "It ain't hurting, Carl. I hurting some,"
the moto protested, and one of his large hands sought out his musher's smaller one.
"Only a little, Runty. Only a little, and it'll soon be over and you'll have a nice kip. My neck hurting, Carl. It's hurting."
The moto's whole body, which was the length of 1.5 men and considerably bulkier, was now part resting on his crumpled neck. Then, with a great heave and a shout from the hauliers, the moto cleared the ground and swung free, a fat, fleshy pendulum spraying pink mist. While all this had been going on, the driver was coming along the bay from his semi, his back stiff, his bright orange trainers glaring as the hem of his black robe rose and fell, his mirror flashing in the fog light, the sign of the wheel embroidered on his breast, commanding attention. Now he came up to the hack's party and turned his back on them. The hack, Mr. Greaves, was staring full into Runty's dying face. "Where to, Gov?" he said to the driver in a cursory fashion. "To New London," came the answer, in RP, with considerably more solemnity. "It's always a fine thing to see a moto slaughter," said Mr. Greaves, grabbing the loose stuff of his long T-shirt with both hands so that it stretched over his pot tank.
"Maybe," the driver snapped. "At any rate, it's a practice the hamsters wouldn't wish to forego."
Carl looked up into the driver's mirror and saw their cold black eyes under high white gull's wing eyebrows. The lad bent back to stroking Runty's muzzle, murmuring,
fair there, Runty, soon over, soon over."
"Why should they forego it, Riavu?" said Mr. Greaves, setting his jaw and thrusting out his long, wispy ginger beard. His nose was bulbous, his brows beetled, his cheeks were tenderized with old pox scars, yet he fronted up well. Still, the driver had got to him, so much so that he had shifted to RP as he bit and nibbled his curry-stung lips.
"Because the moto is real, not toyist."
The driver's voice was low, but his enunciation was perfectly clear. Even in chit-chat, he sounded like a zealot.
"And only toyist beasts may be scoffed."
"Come off it, Dad!"
Mr. Greaves was up for a bit of bother, and the dads, who'd by now finished lashing Runty to the gibbet, came up to hear them.
"The moto is a sacred creature, ordained as such by the book."
"On one reading, perhaps."
The driver hooked his hands into the side vents of his robe, mimicking Mr. Greaves's posture.
"However, on the true one, as higher authorities would tell you if you listened clearly, it is an abomination."
The chillmen, both the hack's peddlers and the sick fares, certainly looked disposed to agree with the driver. Carl recognized two of the older peddlers. They'd been in the party on previous summers, while the rest of them, some 20 dads in all, had never visited Ham before. In the lad's eyes, fares and peddlers alike were a motley crew, their awkward bones an ill fit for their scrawny hides. Their blue caps, yellow tops and red jeans were garish, babyish even, and naturally most of them bore fresh pox scars or weeping goiters. The chillmen stood as close to the hack as their rank allowed and stared at the moto with frank disgust.
"It looks like an abomino what's it to me," said a slight man,
whose bald head was cloven by a fresh trepanning wound.
"It has the eyes of a human, the teeth, the cock and balls too. His feet are like hands with pads of flesh melted into them, but his muzzle is like a burger kind's. And his body is like that of an hideous bay cone. It does me fucking head in."
"Me too. Yeah, me too,"
the other chillman cried. Carl continued to cradle Runty's upside-down head in his arms, heedless of the blood coursing down his neck and blotting out his T-shirt. With one hand, he held an ear flap closed. With the other, he stroked the moto's bulging yonk ears. He went on whispering into the beast's free ear,
"Fair there, Runty, fair there, my sweet."
But it seemed doubtful that the moto could hear him.
for his baby blue eyes were rolled back in their sockets, while his breath came in a laboured squeak and his blood continued to pulse. Then Runty gave a final convulsive shudder, arching his long back, snapping the ropes. Before, the dying creature had lisped in an undertone. Now, a single clear statement issued from his already bluing lips.
I sleepy now. Gonna be with Dave.
Then he went completely slack. Carl stepped back from the gibbet, letting go of Runty's head, and plodded away, his face averted so the dads couldn't see his tears.
Bloody hell,
the cloven-headed chillman said wondrously.
It's true, then, that they speak.
Well, I like to think that that was all completely clear to you. But I feel that I must give you the benefit of the doubt and ask if any of you have any questions, whether you'd like to put them to me. These can be, as I always say on these occasions, can be profound questions about the nature of modern literature, philosophic questions, questions about politics, or they can be prurient questions about my personal life. I really don't care. Sometimes the prurient questions are better. Sometimes they're not. It's really up to you. I really will do my best to answer whatever you can throw at me. I think you can expect no less. Sorry? Well, I did read you the definition before I read the piece. Were you not listening? Shall I read it to you again? It doesn't really tell you much, actually, but I'll read it to you anyway. A moto is a large, viviparous, omnivorous mammalian creature, native to Ham and found nowhere else, used by the hamsters as a source of meat and oil alone. The moto has the functional intelligence of a 2.5-year-old human child. You're doing. I play the part of your memory. It's, I don't, the motos are there because, I mean, if you read the novel, part of the business of creating quite fantastical worlds is, oddly enough, to make them grounded in a strange kind of fact. And once I'd raised the sea level high enough to turn the top of Hampstead in London into an island, I had an island that was too small to support the population I wanted on it without a strange and fabulous beast that they could live off. So that was one reason for creating the moto. It was purely practical. Another one was I was reading to one of my kids a book which some of you may be familiar with, which is Little House in the Big Woods by Laura Ingalls Wilder. I don't know if any of you have read those books or that series of books, but it's actually a very, very brilliant and clear and factual description of what life was like, rural life in the US was like in the mid-19th century. And there's one chapter at the beginning of that book that's called Slaughter Day, which is about Pa, the paterfamilias, slaughtering the family pig. And it's a beautiful bit of writing, and the slaughter of this animal is perfectly described. But I think the most interesting thing for a contemporary reader is how, at the end of slaughtering this animal, Pa takes out its bladder, washes it in the horse trough, blows it up, ties it off, and gives it to the two little girls to play with as a balloon. And Laura Ingalls Wilder's last line after this description of a slaughter is to say, "Slaughter day was always such fun." And it really struck me that, you know, that a measure of our kind of, as it were, natural deracination, our alienation from things like our food, is how incongruous a statement like that seems. So I wanted to write a scene that brought the reader really into the slaughter of an animal. And I thought another way to really point up the strangeness of this was to have a talking animal.
have an animal that spoke. Anybody else? Sir? Sorry, I didn't catch the first part of that.
What was the book of will, if you like?
Yeah, but what was the first part? Oh. Yes. Well, that's a good question. I do write on politics quite a lot and tend to be more of a system demolisher than a system builder. And I suppose it's slightly special pleading to argue that it's a different job description. You know, you need some people to criticize and some people to produce policy. I mean, I've never really been interested in producing public policy like that. I mean, I think the thing that irks me most, I mean, I was writing today on a speech that Alan Johnson, the Education Secretary, had given yesterday to the Fabian Society in London, in which he really wanted to have his cake and eat it. He wanted to try and claim what I think New Labour have tried to claim all along, which is that that you can have all the goodies you like, and you can have what they call a kind of flexible and dynamic economy, while the education system will somehow mysteriously heal the enormous social inequality that such a system produces. And lo and behold, here he was in that speech saying the same thing again. And I think, my book would be, Oscar Wilde said that England was the native land of the hypocrite, and really just abolishing hypocrisy like that would do it for me. I'd rather Alan Johnson got up and said, look, basically what we believe in is that we can create an education system in which maybe 10 or 15% of working class kids will have an opportunity to escape menial, underpaid and insecure work. And we'll do that. But the rest of you are on the scrap heap. And I think that would be more, I'd rather he said that than all of this kind of flim-flam, really. So less hypocrisy, because there's always heaps of hypocrisy to go around. Anybody else? That was pretty downbeat, wasn't it? That was pretty down. He has a set of a rather dotty old aunt who's become a Mormon, and just as he's beginning to have his breakdown, he goes to the Mormon Tabernacle in South Kensington, and is very taken by. Or rather, sort of some of the Mormon stuff gets mixed up in his delusions. So the form that his Ten Commandments take is, I don't know if you're familiar with Mormonism, but it has a book called The Doctrines and Covenants. So that's his form of the Ten Commandments. Yeah, he does have a set of kind of moral prescriptions, all of which really derive from his kind of Fathers for Justice rage about the end of his marriage and the loss, as he sees it, of his kind of paternal rights. So they're all things like men and women are to live apart, the kids are to go back and forth between them, and so on. It's like that kind of thing. And lo and behold, these things rather horribly do come to pass. Sir? Well, it'd be weird if you were a writer who had no fondness for language, wouldn't it? Though they do exist. Jeffrey Archer springs to mind. Yeah. No, I don't know you. I mean, I've never clapped eyes on you before. I mean, either you're psychotic or something strange is going on with you, certainly. Yeah, but that's not a question, that's a statement of fact. I would accept that. I mean, I think it's a question, or, it's an observation that is often made. Put it this way, it's not obscure to me. I mean, quite clearly I'm saying exactly what I want to say in the way I want to say it. It would be ridiculous otherwise. I think that, I'm an unashamed modernist. I mean, I'm a child of Joyce or Virginia Woolf or Juna Barnes, or, I think that there is the problem with
You know, I'm interested not in creating works that are kind of willfully difficult, but works that reflect the richness and complexity of life as I perceive it. And you know, we have this incredible language, which is really a kind of enormous argo. You know, we have two or even three complete vocabularies. And I sort of think, well, why not use them? I mean, there they are. I mean, you only have to... I mean, you open dictionaries, I open dictionaries too, and, you know... You know, if you check a word in the shorter OED, the two-volume OED, and, you know, that's my life work. I do that the whole time. I never fail to see a word I don't know, if not ten, within the same purview. You know, and I don't willfully collect them in order to use them to bamboozle you, who I don't know. But, you know, it does strike me that it's a strange situation, isn't it, where we have this incredible and enormous vocabulary, and yet there seems to be such an enormous insistence on kind of not using it. It's rather like having a kind of, it's like going, being a mechanic and having a vast socket set and saying, yeah, but I'm only going to use this one. I mean, I'm just going to force it onto that bolt. Oh, I'm sorry your car's a bit fucked up. I only use one or two spanners in this garage. Yeah, oh, you'll get over it, mate. You know, whatever. It's sort of, I slightly feel like that. But you know, I write some things that have more plain language. It just depends on what the subject demands. I'm writing a book at the moment that only uses seven words, all of which you know. And only two of which are definite articles. Does that satisfy you at all? Or would you like me to come round to your house and shampoo your stair carpet?
I'm not sure about that, but one of the ways you
self-consciously do all these things. No, I don't. I really, really don't. I mean, if you write for... The great thing about writing fiction is that you don't know who... Your ideal reader is the person who... wants to read the book you've written. You know, we're not like New Labour. We don't go out and do focus groups and say, well, would you read a section of this and I'll see whether you like it and I'll make the rest of the book like that if there's enough of you. It's not that way around. You know, we write what we want to write, and if you want to read it, fine. If you don't, you can walk away. I mean, it's not that sort of a medium. So it's not done in that way at all. It's astonishingly, I mean, Maureen's here, there are other writers here. You know, it's a very, very isolated business, writing. And you know, I mostly sit in a room alone. And I've never seen you there. I mean, you must be very tiny and quiet as a church mouse. Anybody else? Yes. Quite a lot, yeah, quite a lot. I mean, yes, quite a lot, yes. And I think that's what people find disturbing, isn't it? Because they think, well, you know, he's created this character who on the surface is homophobic, misogynistic, bigoted, racist, anti-Semitic, violent, not very good looking. What redeeming features does the character have? But, you know, I sort of think, I tend to read, I don't read a great many novels, but I find a lot of characters in novels incredibly sanitized. They're not actually, and they're usually kind of morally sanitized for the purposes of presenting fiction as in some sense redemptive. And I think people like that. People like the idea. That's my impression. I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, and feel free to. But I think that there's a certain very obvious catharsis people look for in narrative fiction, which is they pick up a book, they identify with the character goes through vicissitudes, and everything comes out all right in the end, either at a kind of internal moral level or preferably at an external level as well. And, you know, that's really not my experience of life, either at the level of individuals or at the level of events. I mean... I don't know about anybody here, but my life really is not like a narrative. It's just not like a story. There has never been a coincidence that has massively changed my life. You know, there's been, do you know what I mean? It's just not been like that. So, yeah, I mean, there is quite a lot of me in Rudman. And I think that most people who, when they are frightened,
give in to bigotry of some form. Definitely. I mean, the world wouldn't appear the way it is, and I think that there's an awful lot of kind of sort of piety in people basically humbug, pretending to not fall prey for that sort of thing. And I don't think it really helps, actually. I think it's better to kind of admit to these things and face up to them. Anybody else? Sir? Yeah, I think that's right, don't you? I mean, it's astonishing, the sort of pornography of violence in our culture, isn't it? I mean, it really is remarkable. I mean, it's so kind of prevalent and seemingly unthinking. It's there like a kind of garnish on drama. Let's blow somebody's brains out or rape somebody. Or, you know, it's really odd. And it's particularly, I think, older people become at one level inured to it because we've seen a lot of this pornography, and at another level revolted and we just don't look at it anymore. I mean, this sounds incredibly sort of curmudgeonly of me, but it's the effect on the minds of the young that really bothers me. Oddly, you know, denatured in that way. I mean, go and sort of, you know, live in Baghdad for a month, and then I bet you won't want to see a violent film when you come back. That's more of an observation than a question, though, isn't it? Yeah. It's a good one, right? Sir? Yeah, I mean, it's strange, isn't it? Because there's a very good essay called 2 Minutes. There's so many books by a Mexican critic whose name always eludes me. One of the statistics he has, I mean, the publication of books has increased exponentially, particularly over the last century, is when it's really sort of gone up in this Malthusian progression. And now there's a book published every 40 seconds. A lot of it is to do with the expansion of academia and the need that people have in academia to publish and to publish things in book form. I think of a lot of people's aspiration to write is not really to do with being a writer. I think that people perceive, in some ways rightly, that if you can write and make a living out of it, it fulfills two ideals that people hold dear. One is self-expression, to be able to express yourself, and the other is to sort of have your own personal coal mine. That you can, you know, that you're kind of not dependent on any boss, you're not dependent on any, I mean, which in the best case scenarios may be true, that a writer is in some sense independent of the ordinary wheel of the kind of commercial and capitalistic system in some way. And I think that's what appeals to people. I don't think when people are thinking, well, I really, really want to write a book, they're thinking, I really want to sit alone in a room for 2 years. I don't think they're actually thinking that. And I think that a lot of people who sort of go for it in that way are soon kind of rather disabused of the idea that they really want to do it that seriously. But I also think that there's a kind of, I don't know, I mean, the fact of the matter is that if things carry on in this way, there clearly are not going to be enough readers because everybody's going to be too busy writing. I mean, it's sort of, you know, and I think there are people who are in kind of public education who sort of think, no, it's all fine, there's just going to be loads more readers and loads more writers and it's just all going to go on getting bigger and bigger, but I'm just not really quite convinced about that. I haven't answered your question. I think some writers, I think like a lot of quite specialised talents, a lot of it is to do with fairly innate characteristics, yes, which is not to say that some people with some of those innate characteristics may not be able to improve them and become writers. But I think that, you know, you can't take somebody with no aptitude and make them into a writer. It's just really... And you can't take somebody who simply wants to be a writer. I mean, I also believe that it's writers are autodidacts as a rule. You know, that's what... They're people who learn themselves. That's what it's about.
Yeah, I mean, they're a different thing, aren't they? I mean, Brief History of Time and a biography of David Beckham. I tell you what would be a really high-selling book would be a book by David Beckham about the implications of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and quantum mechanics. I would read that any day. I mean, as long as you'd spun it out to 80,000 words, because it would be so surreal, wouldn't it? If you sort of, I mean, we're going back to violence, we wouldn't want to do it like this, but if you could coerce Beckham into writing such a book, imprison him, I wouldn't want to torture him, but maybe just tread on his foot very hard occasionally and make him write this book, that would be an amazing book, wouldn't it? I don't know where I've gone now. Are you all still here? Yeah, it is odd, isn't it? It is. Clearly, some books are sort of status objects. Somebody asked me on the TV yesterday, actually, to talk about classics that people buy and don't read. I mean, I've got hundreds of books I haven't read in my house. I mean, it's sort of, they're part of the kind of shingle of reading in that way. And owning a book is a kind of aspiration. And what's wrong with that? You know, you may not read Remembrance of Things Past, but, you know, buying it is a kind of positive statement. It's saying, you know, in theory, I'd like to read Proust. You know, it just so happens that I've got to scratch my crotch and go to the laundrette, but in an ideal world. Anybody else in this idea? Yes. He wasn't inspired by a real cabbie. Every line of this book has been authenticated by a real cabbie, though. It is completely cab-approved. Absolutely right down to the last jot. And the cabbie who I kind of did a lot of the research with, sort of became a friend, was a friend of a friend. And he kind of demonstrates that, I think people's, you know, that in a sense people read, people get into London cabs and they have a kind of stereotype of the London cabbie as a kind of, you know, Daily Mail meets Attila the Hun kind of, you know, bigot, and all the things that sort of that Dave is party to in some ways. But I mean, the guy who I researched this book with is a London cabbie and a psychotherapist. So, you know, it's actually quite a broad church. I mean, he's an East End third generation London cabbie, but he also works as a psychotherapist. So, you know, I think it's lazy of us to always pigeonhole people. Coming back to what you were saying, as securely as that, but and inevitably, one of the weird things are the guy who helped me with the book. I mean, I didn't show him the book until it was finished. But weirdly, some of the things about him, his personal life that he hadn't told me, did crop up in the character, almost as if I'd amazingly intuited them. Freaky, eh? Anybody else? Up the back there. I'm currently in dispute with a French film director who has made one of my stories as a feature. No, I mean, I certainly haven't actively resisted it. No, I mean, there are various things that have been optioned for years. I mean, my novella Cock has been on the verge. I mean, it's so easy to make. It's just about a woman who grows a penis. I mean, for Christ's sake, I mean, you know, make it. Has been optioned in Hollywood for sort of a decade, and they're always on the verge. Every year they sort of say, they've even had notices in Variety saying which pricks are attached to this cock. But the filming never actually starts. I think that's, you know, a lot of writers' experience. I mean, Amos said, you know, never believe they've made a film until you rent the video. You know, it just, you can just, so, but no, it's not something I've actively resisted. No. You know, I've even sort of, it's not my medium. I mean, you sort of, there's only so much time. We'd all like to direct, right? I mean, we'd all like to. And if I had another parallel life, I might adapt some of my own books, but it's not to be. They're interested in cock and not bull. I just don't know. There's a very good script for it, and they've got a proper script and everything. It just can't get that cock
up. Gentleman here.
Wow. Well, yes, a coach will be arriving shortly, and we will all be driving down the, where are we, M6 and then the M40 to London. I'll take you to them on a little tour. Yes. Lots, God, what a strange idea. And if only we could do it. One of my favourite London places, there's so many. I like places that have vantage points where you can see the city. And interestingly, though you see London on film a lot, the number of interesting long shots of London and the Thames Valley are few and far between. So if I was just to give you a few interesting points, there's a place called... One Tree Hill, north of Honor Oak Reservoir in Peckham, where you get a really unusual and unseen view of central London. The manor house on top of Stanmore, where Air Chief Marshal Dowding directed the Battle of Britain, is another astonishing long view where you can see all of London and the Thames Valley from, and I've never seen it on film. Ditto a weird place on the North Downs called the Nor Chalk Pinnacle, which gives you where you can see from Heathrow in the west to the Queen Elizabeth II Bridge in the east in a single saccade. Again, a view I've never seen represented anywhere. So that's just three places for starters. Merriam Park down in Woolwich, where Antonioni filmed Blow Up, is well worth going and having a look at, and that whole area around the Woolwich Ferry is very strange. I could go on all night. It's a big city, mate. Will that do? Are you going to go to those places? Good. Anyone else? Madam. Well, I'm kind of not, there's been, I think one or other of my books has been translated into about 20 languages, something like that. Everything from Turkish to Hebrew to Russian to Japanese. Yes, so they have been translated. I'm huge in Turkmenistan. They don't mention that when they talk about the regime change there, but I've been extremely influential, and effigies of me are seen. The Turkmen Bashis parade effigies of me often. Yeah, golden effigies of me. It's a little embarrassing. I don't like to talk about it too much, but, it's a fact. They don't translate well. They're hellishly difficult to translate. I run through translators. I think, that the languages that are closer, they're big problems. I mean, every writer who writes demotic has problems being translated into German because it's a language that's incredibly resistant to the demotic. I mean, French is pretty bad. I'm not enough of a linguist to really be able to judge the quality of translations, but I think that it's a mixture, really, of the kind of, you're right, the humour, the specificity of the way that the cultural references work with the humour, the way in which I use language, all of those, I think, militate against effective translation. Yeah, it is a problem. So while they have been translated a lot, I've only, to date, in fact, sold 2 copies. Listen, I think that you've been a very, very accommodating audience, and I'd like to say this because it's not something you usually hear often when you come out to a literary event, but you're also all extremely good looking, and I think, and I know people talk about these things and what does that matter, and but it matters to me. There's a kind of inner, I'm not talking about obvious or crass bodily things. It's a kind of inner beauty. And yeah, you're hot as well, but, you know. And I'm going to finish now, but I'll be around for a while at the bookshop to sign some books at the seductive price point, an honest price point of £6. Thank you all for having me.